Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I've been honest. I said, I am going to be putting on the greatest killers you've ever seen.
One of the greatest killers he was referring to, James Mattis, is nominee for defense secretary. And let's look now at the ways in which Donald Trump is already beginning to make U.S. foreign policy. The biggest thing for the media so far has been his phone call with the president of Taiwan, followed by his in-your-face tweeting about it as a challenge to China. Some China experts do like this move, despite the risks of provoking China this way. One question I have about it, this doesn't look to me like an America First policy. I'll explain in a minute. But there's also his phone call with the president of the Philippines, the strongman leader Duterte, which Duterte is spinning as Trump's support for his murderous anti-drug policy. And based on articles I've read from separate news organizations, Trump's picks for national security advisor and defense secretary, General Mattis and General Michael Flynn, both seem to want to pick a fight with Iran, maybe even a shooting war. And there's more. So let's talk to Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and is author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and The Plot to Change the American Way of War. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks.
First on Taiwan, can you explain to people who don't understand it, which is most of us, why do we sell arms to Taiwan like it's its own country, but our president can't talk to their president as if Taiwan is part of China?
Yeah, this is one of these peculiarities. You know, it's not the only peculiarity in foreign policy. For example, we have this enormous base in Cuba called Guantanamo, where there's a prison and there's a military base, and yet it belongs to Cuba, which, you know, until very recently we didn't even have diplomatic relations with. How could that possibly be? The idea is that, you know, many years ago, Communist China was not recognized by the United States as a legitimate country, and Taiwan was the Republic of China. During the Nixon administration, after the overtures to China, the UN changed this. All of a sudden, Communist China got the seat at the UN, and ever since then, Taiwan's status has been ambiguous. It is not recognized as an independent country. There's a policy called China has declared, and we have accepted that there is one China, and that is the People's Republic of China. And on the one hand, we don't recognize Taiwan as a separate independent country. On the other hand, we do sell them arms to prevent a war, to maintain a balance of power. And yeah, this is kind of contradictory. Is it untenable? No. It's been working for, you know, about 30 years now.
And there are people who say, like Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, that this actually works pretty well. We let China save its face. And, you know, I think what China is most afraid of, and I think what Haass thinks China is most afraid of, is other areas of China breaking away. That's why they're so
Tibet, for example.
That's why they're so hawkish on Tibet too. They don't want their country, which does all. We don't think of China as diverse in the way that we think of diversity usually, but China has a lot of different ethnicities, and the Beijing government doesn't want a lot of breakaway regions and things like that. So they get to save face by saying there's this one China policy. Meanwhile, Taiwan gets to live as if they're an independent country. They have a democratically elected government. They have a capitalist economy. And so everybody pretends and everybody kind of gets along. That's the argument for the policy working, and that Trump shouldn't roil those waters.
Yeah, nobody wants to change this, really. Now, here's what disturbs me, Brian. If Trump were a really strategic guy, or if he were surrounded by strategic guys, and they said, you know, this is nonsense, and we need to use this as a lever to pressure China on other things, you know, South China Sea or something with their currency or doing something with trade. You know, that would be kind of dangerous but interesting. There are these stories that have emerged in the last couple of days claiming that this was a very deliberate phone call. He did this precisely for strategic reasons. I don't buy it. I think this was just one of many phone calls that he's taken or made where he just talks off the cuff. Every president-elect, you know, gets phone calls like this. They also have with them someone from the State Department or a State Department briefing book or a State Department briefing. Because, look, when the president, when he doesn't seem to realize that other leaders put a lot of stake in what is said in a conversation with a president or president-elect of the United States. You know, he tells the president of Pakistan, oh, you're a terrific guy. Oh, you're a fantastic country. Your people are fantastic. It's great. Yeah, I'm going to make a visit there. Well, you know, if you're a leader, if you're the president of Pakistan, you're saying, wow, he supports me. This gives me a lot more leeway than I thought for me to do whatever I want to in Afghanistan or with India.
But do we make too much of it when that's our response to him saying you're a terrific guy to the president of Pakistan, who we keep trying to cultivate as an ally? They're kind of a frenemy, I guess. But that doesn't say this is their first. Maybe this is their first conversation they've ever had. It probably is. Certainly the first.
No doubt.
Certainly the first as president-elect. And maybe that's just Trump's style of making a courtesy call.
That's not how.
And that doesn't say you can go attack India with nuclear weapons, right?
Well, that's, listen, he doesn't understand that this is how that people take, when a president of the United States says, yeah, I'm going to come to your country or I'm inviting you to my country, that is a big deal. And he doesn't seem to know that that's a big deal, and therefore saying it as if to say, you know, to some friend when he's walking out of Jean Georges, hey, yeah, let's get together sometime.
Yeah.
You know, it's messing things up.
Taiwan, not everybody hates this. John Huntsman, the Republican moderate who was President Obama's first China ambassador, praised it. So did others who were not confrontation junkies. Orville Schell at the Asia Society said it might be okay. What do you make of the potential risks and benefits for the U.S. of Trump, either on purpose or by accident, raising the profile of Taiwan?
Well, first of all, I think the reason why people who are particularly savvy on Asia are trying to make the best of this is because they know what a mess it's created, and so they're trying to make the best of it. Again, this is there are many areas of the world in which there are things known as strategic ambiguity. Okay, and if he wanted to confront this, if he were really saying no, I don't like this ambiguousness here, let's deal with it and let's use it as leverage for something, I would, you know, again, I think it would be perilous but interesting and maybe worthwhile, but he's doing these things at random, with no idea. I tell you, a way to look at this where local people here in New York might understand. Remember when Hillary Clinton was running for Senate back in 2000, and someone said, "Are you going to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade?" And she said, "I hope so." Now she didn't understand that back then, this was just rife with all kinds of issues.
It was the ability of
gay people
to march
were being banned from it
under their banner
she
issue.
She just thought
right.
It was a nice parade.
Right.
I think it's the same thing with Trump saying,
probably
oh,
so.
It's the president of Taiwan.
But
you know?
But then he backed this up. If he stumbled into it, he doubled down on it. And this is one of the places it starts to get weird for me, is the mixed signals that they've sent since the phone call. So, like, on Sunday morning, Mike Pence made some rounds on the Sunday morning talk shows to downplay it as just a congratulations call to Trump for winning the election, not any indication of policy. Here's a short clip of an example of Mike Pence.
They reached out to offer congratulations, as leaders around the world have. And he took the call, accepted her congratulations and good wishes.
But after that aw shucks appearance on ABC This Week, Trump tweeted this in response to the criticism of the phone call, quote, Did China ask us if it was okay to devalue their currency, making it hard for companies to compete, heavily tax our products going into their country, the U.S. doesn't tax them, or to build a massive military complex in the middle of the South China Sea? I don't think so. That was Trump's tweet. So if it's policy to elevate Taiwan, fine. But why would Pence go on TV and say, oh, shucks, it was just a courtesy phone call, and then Trump double down on it just a few hours later?
Gee, Brian, are you suggesting that maybe the transition team is in flux and great chaos?
Yeah, I guess I'm suggesting.
You know, this is nothing new. You know, Trump has a Twitter compulsion disorder. He just bursts out with exclamations of this sort. And see, this is it. I mean, he has said, you know, I want to be unpredictable. I want people to think that I'm unpredictable. I want the world's leaders to think I'm unpredictable.
You just called it strategic ambiguity. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing. But in his case, he's stirring up all kinds of stuff. There are protocols about how a president of the United States behaves, and if he wants to shake up those protocols, okay, but he should know that a lot of the world is going to be nervous. The United States is also, you know, we are a balancing power. We are basically a status quo power. And if he wants to shake up the rest of the world, he better have a plan on where he wants to take it next. And my concern is that it's clearly that he doesn't. I mean, why is he taking so long to pick a Secretary of State? The reason, I think, is that he doesn't know what kind of Secretary of State he wants.
Right.
You know, if you know
right.
what kind
Not
of Secretary
what
of State
kind
you want...
Because there's no Trump doctrine on foreign policy
if
yet.
If you know what kind of person you're looking for, then, you know, you have three choices or whatever, and you go talk with him. But he's talking with people all over the place, and now he's widening the search. He doesn't know what he wants. And look, in some senses, this is... It's not out of the ordinary. You know, nothing really prepares you for the job of the president of the United States. And here's a guy who's never really been exposed to the kinds of issues that a president has to deal with, especially in foreign policy, which, oh, my God, turned out to be a lot more complicated than he figured. But coming into it, that being the case, it's a little unwise to start making statements that turn out to be provocative, and then, as you put it, doubling down on them instead if you don't know where you're going with it.
Deborah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah. Deborah, you there? I guess not. Okay, we'll go to another call in a minute. One other thing about Taiwan before we move on to some other issues. To my eye, highlighting Taiwan represents a Trump foreign policy dilemma. And again, this is if he's even thinking in logical terms rather than just saying what comes to his mind. Enhancing the legitimacy of Taiwan would be part of a democracy agenda, supporting a democracy because it's a democracy. That's what some of the neocons who like this are saying. But that's the opposite of America First, which generally says we will do business with dictators as long as they're acting in the interest of the United States. With Putin and Assad, for example, that's been Trump's campaign stance. That's what America First means, correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of foreign policy. So how does elevating Taiwan as an issue because they're a democracy become consistent with that?
Well, he's also been trashing China from the beginning. He seems to think that they are artificially lowering their currency all the time, which actually they haven't done in about 5 years. He blames them he blames China and Mexico for the loss of all industrial jobs that have happened here. So, and you know, it's interesting. A lot of presidents, including George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, have come into office bashing China for one thing or another. And then they get in and they say, oh, you know, actually maintaining stable relations with China is there's something to this for a lot of reasons. And maybe Trump will settle down to that position as well. But I think he just sees this it's hard. Look, I am neither an insider in that camp, obviously, nor am I a psychohistorian or a psychiatrist. So I hesitate to attribute motive to Trump on any of this.
Right.
From observation and seeing it in light of lots of other tweets that he puts out there and other random phone calls that he's made with world leaders where, you know, he really shouldn't be telling the head of Kazakhstan that you know, you've created a miracle over there. It just seems like another random act, and it's the randomness that concerns me, really.
So until we bring on the psychologists, we're stuck with Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and is the author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and The Plot to Change the American Way of War. Caroline in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Caroline.
Oh, good morning. So I have a comment, I guess, or a question. So I read in the Daily Mail back in October that the Chinese manufacturer of about 100,000 pairs of Ivanka shoes, which is a company that Trump owns, is moving operations to an African country, to Ethiopia. So I'm just curious whether, you know, Trump will be an example and move businesses that he has interest in, of course, that aren't actually owned by governments, to the United States, And
it's
also,
go ahead.
I'm just curious whether or not this move is also an effort to avoid the tariffs that he plans to impose on Chinese-made products or imports.
Well, according to his tweet after the carrier deal, like we were discussing in the last segment, it wouldn't just be against China. It would be against many potential American companies that move jobs out of this country and then try to import their products back here. You know, Fred, to Caroline's main point, on one of the Sunday talk shows, they tried to pin Mike Pence down on this, on whether Trump would set an example as somebody who does have companies, and I guess his daughter has companies too, that make products overseas and use that low-wage foreign labor and then import them into the United States. And he just kind of squirmed around and didn't answer the question. But I could see this in particular becoming a bigger deal if the media is willing to push it and the Democrats are willing to push it when Trump says one thing and does another thing with his own business.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been noted that those hats that he makes and other things are made abroad, made in Asia. But just one really quick thing. China has been investing in Africa for many years. That's one of their things. And you know, also when you look at what a country like China does or any country does, it's always a common American mistake to look at what they do in terms of what we do or say. And often countries have their own interests, and they do it for their own interests, quite apart from anything that a president says or what we're doing. But, you know, there was a very good article, I think in the Times a few days ago, talking about the global supply chain of even simple manufactured goods, how, you know, a little sliver of a chip is made in China, and then the people assembling it are in Mexico, and then this other thing that glues it together comes from England. I mean, I'm making up things, but the point is that there is a global supply chain that has been developed over a period of years it happens because of efficiency. These people make this more cheaply. These people make that more cheaply. And you might be one little microchip might have products from three or four different countries.
Right.
And if you start disrupting that or start taxing bits of it, you might even be messing around and damaging an American manufacturing company, which might depend on China or some other country for one little sliver of what they do. And if you put a 40% tax on it, then they become less competitive with some other company that will then do it much more cheaply. So,
right. And those are the complexities that they'll have to navigate. if they're going to try to have this kind of government intervention.
Yep, exactly.
I said at the top I wanted to ask you an Iran question. Here's my Iran question. An article on Politico this week is called James Mattis's 33-year-old grudge against Iran, which goes back to the 1983 Iran-linked bombing of the U.S. Marine barracks in Lebanon that killed 241 Americans, including 220 Marines. Mattis is a Marine and is said to have been spoiling for a fight with Iran ever since. And General Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, is so obsessed with Iran that after the Benghazi attack, when Flynn was working for President Obama, Flynn pushed and pushed his staff to find a link to Iran, which they never did because there didn't seem to be one, according to an article in the Times. So if the defense secretary and the national security advisor both have it in for Iran, does that suggest to you an enhanced likelihood of some kind of war with Iran?
Well, look, Mattis and Flynn are generals who I think could not be more dissimilar. Mattis is hawkish on Iran. He thinks that Iran, he has said that Iran is the major source of instability, the major threat to the stability of the Middle East. But he has also said, he's also very much against just barging into places. He thinks the war in Iraq was probably a mistake. He is very keen on allies. He thinks that we shouldn't start messing around militarily in countries, especially Middle Eastern or Muslim countries, without allies going in with us. The thing about Mattis, I wrote a column recently, and I concluded it sort of two cheers for Mattis as Secretary of Defense.
Uh-huh.
On the one hand, you know, I think the principle of civilian control of the military is very important. It was very explicitly stated by the Founding Fathers. The 1947 Act that created the Department of Defense said that the Secretary of Defense, that no military officer who is retired less than 10 years ago can be Secretary of Defense. This was later changed to 7 years ago. Mattis retired in 2013. If he becomes Secretary of Defense, Congress would have to pass a waiver for him. I think they will. He's very popular. On the other hand, Flynn, as Trump's national security advisor, right down the hall from the Oval Office, should be for everybody a source of major concern. And the fact that you also have Mattis, a four-star general, retired four-star, to Flynn's three, and I don't know, Trump seems to have this bromance with generals now,
yeah.
He will counter, I think, the influence of Flynn. Mattis, I mean, he's a very smart guy. He's said to have a library of 7,000 books. When he was on the battlefield, he carried Marcus Aurelius in his knapsack. He's a smart guy. His entire life is devoted to the study of war and history. If he's facing an uncertainty on the battlefield, he'll go back and read history about similar circumstances. He has these crazy nicknames like Mad Dog, the Warrior Monk. His radio code when he was in Iraq in the first war was chaos. He says things like, you know, he used to tell his people in Iraq, you know, be professional, be courteous, but be prepared to kill everybody that you meet. Hey, listen, a lot of generals would leave out the courteous and professional part, right?
Yeah.
These are two very different people. I think there will be increased tensions with Iran. I think there might have been under President Hillary Clinton as well. But I don't. If Mattis maintains the upper hand over Flynn, I don't see us just barging in on a war with Iran.
One follow-up on Mattis, and then we're out of time. A listener tweets, I'm worried about giving waiver for Mattis. Sends message to Trump, it's okay to bend rules. Are you worried about this, Fred Kaplan? And that's an interesting way to put it, that
if
Mattis is a good pick, and so maybe it's a good idea to to give him the waiver, you know, that allows a recent general to serve in this civilian office, that it sends a general message to Trump that he can bend the rules.
Well, it's not unprecedented. Congress passed a waiver once before in 1950 to allow five-star General George Marshall to become Secretary of Defense. Now, it's a little different. Marshall wasn't a warrior. He'd been a staff officer. He was the Army Chief of Staff in World War II. And before he became Secretary of Defense, he'd been Truman's Secretary of State. So he had a broad perspective.
Right.
My concern about
right,
Flynn,
but you get the the listener's
point.
What's our big concern? One of our biggest concerns about Trump is that he's going to become an autocratic strongman and actually weaken our democracy. And in order to do that, he has to think that he's got license to some degree to bend the usual rules of democracy. And so if this sets a precedent, you know, it could be a one-off or it could wind up setting a precedent in his mind. So I just think the listener raises an interesting
concern.
No, it's
a very good point, and that's why I said two cheers for Mattis, not three. I think in this situation, given the alternatives of who he was considering for SecDef and given maybe the need for someone like Mattis to counter the influence of someone like Flynn, I'm willing to bend a bit on this one.
And so what about your boy Petraeus?
My boy Petraeus.
I say because you wrote a book about him. I think you wrote a book about him without having an affair with him. Is that right? Unlike the
author? I'm the one who didn't have an affair with
him. And he didn't leak classified information?
No, I'm afraid he didn't. Not to me.
I was going to read your book, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Look, I don't know who's going to be Secretary of State.
Would it be too many? I guess my specific question is
too many generals.
Too many generals, and that's going to be a deal breaker.
I think that works against him. It could be that even Trump might buy the argument that I don't want to have a general. I guess everywhere as my national security advisor, as my Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State to have a general. It might go too far. And Petraeus has a few other... I mean, I don't know if Trump does not seem to show any signs of being concerned about looking hypocritical, but it would be really quite something if after calling Hillary Clinton, you know, crooked Hillary, lock her up because she mishandled classified information, then to hire in your cabinet someone who was actually prosecuted.
Yeah, exactly
he's
that.
He's on 2 years probation. If Petraeus wants to go to Europe because he's Secretary of State and there's a conference in Europe, he would have to get permission from his probation officer to do that.
Huh. Well, that's an impediment.
Well, he would get it, I'm sure, but still, it raises hypocrisy to a new and rather stunning level.
Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate and is author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.